good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center's Pinwheel Education Series on self-harm and healthy coping tools. The Pinwheel Education Series is a monthly forum that brings together experts and persons with lived experience to talk about mental health and mental wellness. Everything related to the Pinwheel series, including a recording of today's session, can be found at www.keltymentalhealth.ca/pinwheel. Now, for those of you that are joining us for the first time, the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center is a provincial mental health and substance use information and resource center serving BC children, youth, and families. We also offer peer support to families and youth, as well as to people of all ages struggling with eating disorders. You can visit our website at www.keltymentalhealth.ca for more information, resources, and for our contact information. Okay, so we're just gonna jump right in. And our first speaker is here in the room with us. So Dr. Ashley Miller is a child and adolescent psychiatrist of BC Children's Hospital and the Northeast Child and Youth Mental Health Team. She completed medical school at McGill University and trained in psychiatry at UBC, where she is an assistant clinical professor. Dr. Miller specializes in child, adolescent, and family psychotherapy and works with the BC Children's Hospital Dialectical Behavior Therapy Program, treating youth with recurrent self-harm. So welcome, Dr. Miller, and go ahead.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak, and thank you to all of you for listening. Self-harm can be a stressful topic and one that we sometimes want to shy away from, so I really want to acknowledge everyone taking the time to come here and learn and talk about it today. I'm going to speak from my point of view as a child psychiatrist. I've worked with lots of youth and adults with self-harm over the last 15 years, but I'm really interested to hear what Maddie has to say as a youth with lived experience, because self-harm is a behavior, and there are many possible meanings to that behavior. So it can be very unique in each circumstance, and we need to keep that in mind, I think, as we think about this topic. Also, there's a real range in self-harm from just very kind of minor or superficial injury to quite severe. So as you're listening, if you're listening on behalf of a youth that you know or you work with or you care for, also to keep in mind that there is that range, and we'll kind of address how we approach people at different ends of that spectrum as we go along. When I talk about self-harm today, I'm going to be talking about non-suicidal self-injury. And so that means deliberate, self-inflicted destruction of body tissue resulting in immediate damage without suicidal intent. And that's not culturally appropriate. I'm not going to be talking about the self-injurious behaviors that are common in children with developmental disabilities. We're going to focus on the pre-adolescent to the young adult range. And although we're talking about non-suicidal self-injurious behavior, there is certainly overlap with suicidal ideation and suicidal behavior. So a little bit later on, I'll be talking a bit about how we differentiate the two and what the overlap is. And I'm also going to be really interested in hearing your questions, because I'm not sure who's in the room and who's listening. And so I'm really, really hoping to save a lot of time for questions at the end. So I'm going to start by explaining a little bit about what self-harm is, and then how we recognize it and what we can do to help. The most common presentation of self-harm that I see, I work mostly in outpatients, but I also do call at BC Children's Hospital. So I've seen people who come in kind of that crisis emergency situation where self-harm is the presenting complaint. And I've also seen youth who are referred by their family doctor, or in community mental health, it might be by a concerned school counselor or directly by a family. I don't think I've ever seen a youth present themselves because of self-injurious behavior. And that's something important to keep in mind too. Kids are not coming to mental health clinicians saying, "I've hurt myself." It may be that the most common thing would be they've told a friend before they tell any adult. And a friend is usually the first line support, the first person who's been trying to help them for a while, often not terribly successfully. Although I tend to see mostly young women, I think that's a bit of an artifact of the adolescent age group and maybe also who presents for treatment, because studies show that self-harm is roughly equal in men and women. It does start younger in women. And we know that it's common across all socioeconomic status groups, all ethnic groups. We don't have good data yet on transgender or gender variant youth. We do know that it seems to be more common in bisexual females, and we're not exactly sure why that is. There are over a dozen forms of self-harm. So we may think of cutting as kind of a very common form, but in fact there's, you know, burning, taking too much or too little medication, piercing, banging one's head. There's lots and lots of different forms, and sometimes people will just do one form, and sometimes they will do up to a combination of 10 or more different forms of self-injury. And self-harm can occur anywhere on the body, most commonly on the hands, the wrists, the abdomen, and the thighs. And the injury, like I said, can be minor. So I've certainly seen kids where it's more scratching at their hands with their fingernails or taking a paper clip, all the way to severe and accidentally life-threatening. So where a person is not meaning to end their life, but through their self-injurious behavior, end up in a situation where it could be life-threatening and they need medical attention. When we put all the studies together, the prevalence of self-harm is about 17% in adolescents. That's quite a high number. And in fact, in studies of adults in the US, about a third have self-harmed at one point during high school. That's an enormous number. The rate decreases to about 5.5% in adulthood. And it really most often onsets between age 11 and 15, and almost always between age 10 and 24. So self-harm really does start in young people. The vast majority of people who have relatively stable lives, even if we do nothing, the self-harm will tend to resolve within 5 years of the time it started. So that's interesting too. There seems to be kind of a developmental process to it. And I see, I would say most commonly, I see self-harm in 14 or 15-year-olds, often that grade 9 year, when there's so much peer pressure, so much what the kids call drama going on in the classrooms. And a lot of those kids, the self-harm behavior does resolve as they get into the grade 10 year, the grade 11 year. And then there is a smaller subset where it does continue and it becomes more entrenched. So we think there's something, there was a Pinwheel series a few weeks ago about borderline personality disorder. And for some of us in mental health, when we hear self-harm, we might jump to think about borderline personality disorder because it is one of the diagnostic criteria of borderline personality disorder. But in teens, we really see that, you know, the teenage brain, there's lots of pruning going on, lots of changes happening. And as part of that whole developmental transition, figuring out identity, figuring out healthy ways to cope are kind of a natural part of that. So we tend to see more self-harm in those early adolescent years. But I have a feeling that something about just how we generally learn emotion regulation and identity developmentally over the period of adolescence, that process of self-harm tends to also kind of subside as many of our youth get a bit older. Now, it can be hard to understand why would someone harm themselves. And I invite you to think about for a minute just some of the behaviors you yourself might have engaged in that weren't always the healthiest, you know, like whether it's drinking or drugs, eating too much, staying up, playing on your phone at night. You know, we all engage in some kind of behaviors that aren't necessarily healthy, but usually make us feel better in the short term. And self-harm is, for the people who use it, it really is a solution, albeit a temporary solution. It relieves overwhelming emotional pain. That's not always the reason, but that's a really common reason. A way that I kind of think about it, or some people have described it, is if you imagine just being in the car, kind of locked in there, you can't get out, and the radio is blasting some music that you just hate, and it's you just feel overwhelmed with this annoying sound. And then you imagine just being able to turn the radio dial so that it suddenly goes off, and then you have this blissful calm from all that noise. And self-harm, it really focuses attention away from all that noise, all that overwhelming emotional pain. So in that moment, for that person, it is a solution, and it relieves their suffering. There are, again, so many different reasons why people self-harm, and so some of it is to deal with overwhelming emotional pain, or sometimes numbness. Sometimes it's the absence of sensation, so someone really wants to cry, but they just can't cry. If they harm themselves, it brings a sensation, and that's a relief in and of itself. for some people who tend to dissociate, so that means kind of, if you've ever seen a movie where someone's like floating on top of their own body looking down, in times of extreme stress or for people who've experienced trauma, they sometimes do that, they dissociate. And self-harm can kind of reconnect the mind and body through that experience of pain, so it can be helpful in that way. Sometimes it's to deal with interpersonal issues, so feelings of loneliness or abandonment. Sometimes it affects change in the people. So if you feel that you're being ignored, but then you harm yourself and your mother or your teacher is now very concerned and paying a lot of attention to you, it's not that you've done it necessarily consciously for attention, but the result is that you get the care and concern that you so desperately want. So I don't think of it so much as doing it for attention, but doing it for connection. And that can be a really powerful motivator, especially if you do get connection from the self-harm, and then it might increase the chance that you're going to continue to self-harm. So not to say we don't want to show care and concern, but I'll get to that a little later, that the way we show care and concern matters in terms of how much the self-harm is going to continue or not continue. There are also a lot of people who are just extremely ashamed by their self-harm. And self-harm is sometimes a way both to deal with shame, and then it causes more shame. Not just because of the visible scars, but also because of the fact that the person has had a bad behavior, quote unquote, or hasn't been able to control their impulses. So basically it's just a lot of factors. And I think our job as adults, caregivers, professionals, is really to help youth disentangle what are all those factors for them that have gone into their self-harm. And it's really important that we don't jump to conclusions, that they're all the same, or that we understand the cause without really going through a detailed analysis with them of what led up to the self-harm. It's also really common that if we try to ask a youth, well, why did you hurt yourself? They'll say, well, I don't know. And that can be frustrating, or sometimes it feels kind of like they're just putting us on. But there's actually a link between people who have difficulty identifying, expressing emotions, and who have difficulty linking in their mind a feeling, an event, and a behavior, are more likely to self-harm. So they literally often have difficulty with that, with actually understanding why they did it themselves. They really often don't know. And so our job as therapists working with these youth, what we often do is we take a really practical approach when we're asking them about an incident of self-harm. We wouldn't say, well, why did you do it, or what triggered you, or something like that. We might go through, more like a detective would, or a journalist, the events of the hours or days leading up to the incident, asking very kind of practical questions. Like, so what were you doing the day before in the morning? You went to school. Did you have any thoughts of harming yourself then? Okay, no. And what did you do after school? I went home and then I checked Facebook. And did you have any thoughts of harming yourself at that point? Oh yeah. Okay, well, what was on Facebook? Somebody wrote this mean post about me. And so then you kind of piece together for them and with them what might have been some of the things that led to the self-harm, because really it's that difficulty just making that connection. And often they have a hard time identifying feelings. Like if you just say, oh, well, were you feeling sad? Some people just don't know, right? They don't feel it in that way. They don't talk about it in that way. And we find in people who have recurrent self-harm, those tend to be pretty common characteristics. So I'm going to come back to the difference between suicidal and non-suicidal behaviors. About 60% of youth who have engaged in self-harm have never had suicidal ideation. So they're definitely not the same thing. And yet, if we look back on the histories of adults who have had a suicide attempt in their life, they're 9 times more likely to have had a history of self-harm behavior. So we know that self-harm behavior is a risk factor for later suicide behaviors or suicide attempts. And that's why we take it seriously when a youth we're seeing in treatment has self-harm behavior. It's a priority for treatment. And that can mean different things, but in dialectical behavior therapy, which I'll talk about a bit more later, they prioritize self-injurious behaviors along with suicidal thoughts or even suicide attempts as kind of the first order target that you want to manage in your therapy. So an example would be, let's say somebody has some history of depression or PTSD, and if we start really trying to get them to talk about their previous traumatic experiences when they are still actively self-harming before they've learned better coping skills, their incidence of self-harm might increase when we start talking about some of the traumatic events. Now, there's some controversy about this. We certainly recommend, you know, treating all things together in a holistic way, but you do have to be aware that if someone is self-harming and doesn't have coping skills, that behavior might increase if you try to deal with other problems first. And if there are questions about that, I'd be happy to talk about that a little bit later. Now, there's a range, and some people self-harm once or twice. It doesn't become a pattern. It might go away just through support from their friends or family, their teachers, community resources, or within any regular kind of therapy. But for those, but they're also youth, where self-harm is kind of a signal. It's really the tip of the iceberg, and it's the only thing that's visible. So we really have to take note when there is self-harm. Sometimes people also think, oh, it's just for attention, so they don't want to kind of reinforce it with attention, and they kind of ignore it. But in fact, self-harm can be a sign of depression, bipolar disorder, psychosis. I've recently treated someone where self-harm was the first presenting symptom of a psychotic disorder. And it's also really common in youth who've been abused. I've seen that very, very commonly. And predominantly sexual abuse. So childhood sexual abuse has a very strong correlation with self-harm. Of course, that doesn't mean that if a youth is self-harming, oh, well, they must have been abused. We never want to jump to that conclusion. But we do want to screen youth who have had self-harm. We want to ask them about if they have any history of abuse or if they've witnessed traumatic events. Eating disorders and substance abuse are also really common with people who self-harm, which kind of makes sense because they're all behaviors to cope with really unpleasant feelings. So the problem with youth starting to self-harm is it can become addictive. They may not mean it to be, but it actually releases our body's own internal opioids, like our own internal morphine, and it can be hard to stop. It can really, and the reason someone starts may not be the reason they continue. It may be hard to stop. It can also be contagious, so you may have heard this, but when you have one youth self-harming in the peer group, this is especially in adolescents, other youth who they're spending time with may start to self-harm. This is also true, we think, for media exposure, and that's why we really encourage the media not to sensationalize episodes of self-harm, or even if it's in like pop stars, to just not make a big deal of it, because it does influence young people. And the same is true with eating disorder behaviors. It's also another reason why youth shouldn't be trying to help each other through their self-harm. And we have had situations where there's been a big group of youth who are self-harming. So as educators or people who are working in community settings, you really want to encourage youth to come to you as an adult for help. And if you're running, you know, workshops or education, you don't really want to give out a list of kind of all the ways that youth could harm themselves or talk about it in that kind of way. More talk about the healthy coping skills and the positive aspects. So how can you tell if youth are self-harming? Sometimes there are obvious signs, like you see cuts, you see bruises. You need to ask, because most youth will try to hide it, either physically by wearing long shirts over their cuts, refusing to change for gym class, things like that, or metaphorically, they'll just tell you, oh, well, the cat scratched me, or I fell in, or something like that. So you do need to ask, and it's really tricky, because sometimes there's an element of control with self-harm, or trying to kind of guard against a feeling of powerlessness. And so they might be really resistant to you trying to ask them about it. They might want to hold on to that as kind of their own power or secret. But what we find is if you're persistent and calm and non-judgmental, then youth will usually eventually disclose about it. And some youth really do want to talk about it. They've just really been struggling with it on their own, and they would really appreciate someone helping them and letting them talk about it. You might actually find cutting instruments or things in the house. Again, it's important to ask the questions if you have the concern. And if you're working with youth who have anxiety, depression, who seem to have a lot of shame, body image concerns, substance use, we just ask, right? It's part of the general screening because these things tend to come together. What do you do when you know a youth is self-harming? So parents often tell me they feel at first very helpless, very anxious, sometimes guilty. It's really important not to take a youth's self-harm personally, and it can be really challenging. This is your child who's hurting themselves, you know, and especially if it goes against religious beliefs. But youth are already, or whoever's self-harming, usually so overwhelmed with their own feelings that what they really need is someone to stay calm, to help them kind of contain all the turmoil that they're going through. And that's a tall order, right? It's pretty hard to stay calm when a youth that you know and care about or work with comes and either you find out or they show you that they've actually been hurting themselves. It's really hard to stay calm. So that's why we recommend, in most cases, professional help, or that parents consult with at least, you know, a family member, support person, a therapist of their own, especially if the youth is refusing treatment. Because I can't say enough about how important it is to try to maintain that calmness. We don't want to be too anxious with the youth. We don't want to shame them, get too angry at them or blame them. All of those things seem to make it worse. Of course, you can express your concern about the youth and that you don't want them to self-harm and that you want to help them get better. But it's kind of that attitude. And just to give you an example of that, there's a young woman who I know who had repeated episodes of self-injurious behavior when she was in her 20s. And the first therapist that she went to would kind of every time ask her a lot about her suicidal ideation, a lot about her self-harm behavior, and just seemed really, really kind of anxious about it herself. And so for this young woman, it was really hard to kind of to work with that and to get better. And what helped her in the end was having a calm, experienced therapist who just wasn't frightened by her. But she said, I was terrified with myself. I couldn't get better if the person I was working with was all just as terrified. So it is scary, but we as the caregivers need to do what it takes for us to be, and I'm including that parents, therapists, kind of everyone, do it what it takes for us to be able to stay calm in the face of the adolescent's turmoil. And also to keep being persistent. So I've definitely had parents bring youth in who did not want to talk about their cutting, did not want to acknowledge the cutting. It's okay, we can talk about other things, like we can talk about the other things that are affecting them. But over time, even if they refuse therapy at first, in this case, the youth after a couple of months realize, yeah, you know what, my cutting is a problem and I do want to get help. And you can use motivational strategies with the youth too. Like, is there, you validate it. So of course you're cutting for a reason. You know, that makes sense. I get that. This is helpful to you right now. And ask them about that. But then you also ask them, well, is there anything you don't like so much about the cutting? And see what their concerns are about it. Is it maybe they don't want to have scars? Maybe they have a new boyfriend and the boyfriend doesn't approve of cutting. You know, so you want to look at their motivation for decreasing it. If you, of course, suspect that a youth is self-harming to manage current abuse or maltreatment, you're going to want to notify the Ministry of Children and Family Development or work with the youth to get out of that situation, because, of course, the self-harm is not going to get better if it's a way to cope with current abuse or maltreatment. And there's all different, we can maybe talk about this a bit later, but there seems to be kind of different groups of youth who self-harm. Some are more perfectionistic and overwhelmed with school stress and wanting to do really well. Some it's to manage previous trauma. Some it's more mood problems and dysregulation. So the treatment, of course, depends on what the combination is of different factors leading to it. And the management of self-harm, if I just talk about some general strategies, there's really good websites that have lists of different things you can try as alternatives to self-harm. Youth in BC actually has a really good list, the Youth in BC website. And some of the classic things we recommend are taking ice and putting it on the back of your neck, or wearing an elastic band around your wrist and snapping it. Something that creates a really strong physical sensation can be helpful. We want to make sure that if youth are not willing to give up self-harm yet, that they're doing it as safely as possible. So cutting, for example, some youth who cut themselves in groups will share instruments, and we really don't want that. And youth are not necessarily going to be ready to cold turkey stop harming themselves from the first day they see you. So you need to really work with youth, much like you would with substance use, on a step-by-step harm reduction basis, knowing that the goal is, of course, for them to have more adaptive coping mechanisms. So the first line treatment really is psychotherapy. And psychotherapy can be with any of our child and youth mental health clinicians in the province. They're all skilled and know how to manage self-harm. A private therapist, most of our private child psychologists, counselors, also are very good at helping youth with self-harm. And then if there's another diagnosis beyond just the self-harm, then of course treatment for that specifically. Medication is very rarely used, I would say almost never on its own, unless self-harm is related to depression or anxiety, where treating the depression or anxiety with medication is going to be helpful. And mindfulness-based practice. Mindfulness is one of the core elements of dialectical behavior therapy, and especially for the youth who are kind of more on that perfectionistic and really driven side. Mindfulness techniques give youth a way to focus their attention, a way to calm all the kind of turmoil in their mind. So that can be effective for that subgroup of youth, but if you've had other things like trauma or other mental health conditions, it wouldn't be enough on its own. And then just kind of last two things, again, sometimes, especially with younger youth, having the family involvement in therapy is really important, or parents, like I said, getting their own support so that they can remain calm and try to help their youth navigate through the self-harm. And it's really only if the self-harm is recurrent, persistent, other kinds of therapy haven't been effective, then we're looking at dialectical behavior therapy, which is like a treatment package that involves individual therapy for the youth, a group treatment program where the parents and youth both attend, and even parents of adults, I think, can attend in the adult groups. And there's often telephone coaching, not with every program, but that's because when someone is about to self-harm, until they've learned the coping skills, it can be really hard to get themselves out of that mode, and knowing that they can call someone and talk to someone reliable is really, really useful. So, and I think one of the next Pinwheel Education series is going to be on dialectical behavior therapy, so that'll be great. I think that's all I want to say right now, and I'm really looking forward to your questions after Maddie speaks.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dr. Miller. So our next speaker is over the phone. I'm just going to unmute you guys here.
Conference is no longer in lecture mode.
Okay, so just a reminder that if you're on the phone, to mute your phones by either pressing the mute button on your phone or *6 to minimize the background noise. And so, Maddie, I'm just going to introduce you here before you speak.
Okay.
Maddie Montero is a provincial and federal youth advocate for mental health. Having experience with mental illness taught her the importance of speaking up, and in hope to inspire, connect, and educate those around her. Mental health is a subject she is very passionate about, and she loves sharing that passion with everyone around her. So welcome, Maddie, and go ahead.
Hi. Okay. So I'm Maddie, and I just wanted to say first, like, thank you so much for having me here and listening to me speak. I mean, I guess you guys don't have much of a choice right now, but anyway, that was super interesting, like, just hearing all that right now. But anyways, so I wasn't 100% sure what you guys wanted me to talk about, but I kind of have the idea, and I'm going to ask you first if it's okay. So I've had, like, I have lived experience with mental illness, and also I relied on self-harm for a coping mechanism for a big chunk of my life. And so what I was going to do is just kind of talk about how I, like, why I think that I got started and kind of how my childhood brought that up and influenced it, and then the different ways I learned how to cope in healthier ways. Is that okay with you guys?
That sounds great, Maddie.
Okay, awesome. So I've always been a really anxious kid, and even right now I can feel myself, I'm like, ah, adrenaline. But I grew up in a household with domestic abuse, and my dad would yell at my mom and hit her, and he was just kind of a bad, he was just kind of not the nicest guy. And so from a young age until I was about 7 when they got divorced, that was a really big stress on me, and it always made me worried. And so I think that was the start of kind of my whole, a lot of problems with anxiety. And after that, so they got divorced when I was 7, and then when I was in grade 5, so I must have been 9, 10, I started going to see my dad on kind of like a weekend basis, like every second weekend I'd go over there, and he didn't really live in the best kind of neighborhood either, so that would make me super anxious. But anyways, he started to abuse me and verbally abuse my little sister. And so at that point in my life, I was super stressed out, and I didn't feel like I could talk about it to anyone because I didn't know anyone who had dealt with this kind of thing or who was. And I didn't want to talk to my mom about it because I didn't want her to be worried. And it actually kind of happened by fluke that I started to self-harm. I got cut, and all of a sudden my brain kind of turned off, and it was just focused on that. And for a kid with, like, anxiety, where my brain is going 24/7, always super fast, hard to keep up with, I was like, wow. Like, I'm not thinking about anything but this right now. And so that's how I kind of started self-harming, was after that incident. And I think that it gave me kind of a release, because I have a lot of kind of issues around control because of the fact that I was abused by my dad, and I never felt like I had any kind of power over my body, and this is something that had given me power because I kept it a secret, no one knew about it, and no one else could do it but me. And even though that's not a healthy thing, that was the only power I had over my body. And so I struggled with self-harm in grade 5, in grade 6, grade 7, grade 8, grade 9, and a bit in grade 10. I think also, you know, the transition from elementary school to high school, and I finally told my mom that my dad was abusing me when I was in grade 7, and so I stopped seeing him. I haven't seen him since I was 12. Oh, and I'm 17 now, or 16 now, 17 2 months, which I probably should have said at the start, but that's okay. and, yeah, and so it was something that I could finally use, and I finally felt that I had a bit of power. And like it was said before, it was something that kind of gave me relief in the moment, and it was generally when I was feeling super anxious or... Here, 1 minute, sorry.
Are you guys busy?
Yeah, I'm just in the middle of the right now. Sorry about that. I have a peer support office at my school, and that's where I'm in right now. Sorry about that. And so, yeah, it finally gave me power over my body. And it was generally when I was feeling super anxious or stressed, and I was just overwhelmed, and I needed to find a way to turn my brain off. And even though, you know, it didn't really turn my brain off, it made me stop thinking and focusing on one thing instead of a million things at once. So in that sense, it really works for me. But the sense of shame that came after I did it and always having to hide it was getting to the point that it was unbearable. So when I was 13, I was sitting at the kitchen table with my mom and my nana and my grandpa, and it was summer and stuff, but I was still wearing a long sleeve shirt. And I reached across the table, and my sleeve rolled up, and my mom saw. And that was the point. She's like, oh, like, what happened? And I was like, oh, I tripped walking the dog. And my mom knew that that wasn't it. And so she kind of took me upstairs, and at first, she was really upset and confused, and she kind of got upset with me. And I know at this point, it's just, you know, she wasn't mad at me, she was just super scared, because that's like, you know, 12, 13-year-old kid, and it's her daughter. And so at that point, she set me up with a counselor, and I started counseling, which I did, I think it was cognitive behavioral therapy. Yeah. And so it took a while. I saw that counselor on and off for, I think, 2 years. Two and a half years I saw her on and off. And I ended up developing better coping mechanisms for me to be able to do or to not revert back to the self-harming. I do a lot of writing now. I love poetry, and I always have. But I never really kind of connected the thing, like, okay, this is something I enjoy, but it's also something that really helps me. I love kind of talking about my story and mental health, and it's something that really fires me up and makes me feel really passionate. And so that's a big thing for me as well. But there are still times, it wasn't like, okay, I got counseling and then it was done. I'm still on medication for anxiety and OCD, and I still sometimes have to take sleeping pills just because I get too anxious and my brain won't stop moving. But I've gotten to the point, I have relapsed a couple of times. In last summer, so I guess the summer between grade 10 and 11, I was raped, and that kind of reverted me back to self-harming because of the fact that it was another thing. I had no control over my body, and that was a way. I had no coping mechanisms that were strong enough to help me kind of get through that. And even thinking about it now, I just recently started talking about it probably a month ago, but I reverted back to that behavior of self-harming, and that lasted just for a couple months until I started talking about it with my counselor. But it's, I think the main thing that I'm trying to kind of get across is, yes, well, different points. Yes, I think my past definitely influenced my behaviors around self-harm. It was a lot either I wanted control over my body because I felt powerless and helpless, and that was something no one else could do but I could. I also have a lot of issues around dissociation, and having that kind of brought me back. And it's like recovery with self-harm for me, and I believe this is kind of an average thing. It's not like you get better and you never think about it again. It's an ongoing thing, and I know, even though I haven't self-harmed or had a cut in a couple months, that I know I have to watch out for myself because I know how easy it is to revert back into that pattern, and how important it is now to have higher developed coping strategies. Yeah, like, is there anything else you want me to touch on?
No, that's Maddie. That's great for now. Thank you very much for sharing.
Okay.
We'll open it up for questions now. So people might have questions for you specifically, or just more generally.
Okay.
So maybe we'll start with the folks that are here via telehealth. Do you have any questions in Powell River for our speakers? Doesn't look like it. No. Okay. How about over the phone? Are there questions for our speakers? And if we're not responding right away, you might not have unmuted yourself.
I have a question for Maddie.
Yeah?
Hi. Thank you so much for sharing all that with us. My question is, you talked about disassociation, and I'm curious to know if did self-harm ever cause you to go into disassociation, or were you using it to come out of that?
When I was in more of a dissociative state, I used self-harm as a way to get myself out of it. And I think it would be different for a lot of people, but sometimes I just felt super numb, and I couldn't feel anything, and I felt like almost as if I was in a movie and I was just watching myself. Like, I wasn't interacting. It was almost like I wasn't existing. And self-harming really, I guess, I don't know if it was the harsh sensation of it or just going back and looking at what I did. It brought me out of the state of dissociation that I was in. And so I, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
No, thank you.
Other questions from those that are on the phone? Okay, we'll come back to the phone if...
We have a question over here.
Go ahead.
We're wondering if Kimmy had any thoughts of suicide at all through her path.
Maddie, I think that question is for you.
Okay, sorry, I wasn't 100% sure. Yeah, I did have suicidal thoughts, and I did attempt suicide a couple times throughout my life, but at the point I was when I was regularly self-harming, it wasn't in the, like, I wasn't trying to commit suicide, but I have had that suicidal, ideation, I can't say that word.
Ideation?
But yeah. Yeah, there you go. But yeah, I have dealt with, you know, suicidal thoughts and suicidal urges and different suicide attempts, but at the time that I was self-harming, it was more unrelated to the suicide and more related to coping right then and right now.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Is that answer your question? I just want to make sure.
Yes, thanks.
Okay.
Okay, other questions from the phone? Okay, let's open it up to the room. Are there questions for our speakers here today? Okay. Go ahead.
For Dr. Miller, we work in a high school, and we're working with, you know, grade 9, 10 adolescent girls. And we've seen those groups of kids that, you know, get together and are self-harming. Do you have any tips for us as to how to manage that in a high school setting in terms of, you know, friendships and, you know, you want support for kids, so you want them to have their friends and their social group, but you don't want them to be doing this together, self-harming together, and that is a support for themselves?
Yeah.
So do you have any ideas for us?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, really challenging when you have a group of kids, and I think it's important to, whether it's a school counselor or a teacher, whoever has the strongest connection with the individual kids, to take them apart, like aside individually, and try to understand what their particular motivations are, if they know. And sometimes they'll say some of the kids may be doing it more for the social connection, whereas others, it might be, usually there's one or two who have the more significant mental health challenges, and the other ones, it's more out of the social connection, or it's just kind of what everyone's doing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to involve the parents of the youth. This is tricky, right? Because there's certain confidentiality and that can kind of go wrong too. But especially the ones who have the more significant mental health challenges, I think you're really wanting to get those ones to mental health treatment that includes the parents. Mm-hmm. And if the youth are harming again because of some abuse or neglect at home, then you're needing to get more wraparound support for those more vulnerable families. Mm-hmm. And I think if you can help those, the other ones where it's less significant, they might still need help, but the behavior might kind of fade away as the more impaired kids get the help. Mm-hmm. Is that helpful? Okay.
Mine is actually two parts. I work at the board office, so I help schools with all kinds of things, and this is one of the things that's kind of fallen into my plate mm-hmm. in the absence of anybody else at this point. So I've just been dealing with a situation. It's in an elementary school. It's grade 6, mm-hmm. 7. Mm-hmm. And a girl who had short-term intervention through mental health, and no referral on to longer, but it's all still continuing, mm-hmm. and the school counselor is feeling like everyone she calls, the door is closing. They say, nope, we can't help you. Nope, mm-hmm. she's not a candidate. Nope. And we've got mom connected up with some help, which the girl may or may not join her mom in this, but the counselor is left with the impression this is not considered a mental health problem. Mm. It is a way this girl's coping. But it's been serious enough that she's been taken to the hospital more than once. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason why mental health would be telling us she's not got a mental health problem? We don't know where else to go.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so I'm not sure what community you're in, but I think it probably...
Vancouver.
It's in Vancouver,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's really a question of severity and, mm-hmm. and resources being overloaded, so
right.
that
yeah.
it doesn't
yeah.
mean that the youth yeah. doesn't need help, but that
right.
it might not be at the particular child and youth mental health team, but
right.
it might be that something like a counselor through Vancouver Family Services
yeah.
or if the family can afford private resources, or if they have employee assistance,
yeah. yeah.
So that might be an option.
Right.
It's really tough for the kids
yeah.
who are seen as the milder,
yeah.
but yet they're not. They're clearly distressed.
Yeah, I wouldn't have said this was a mild situation.
So if it's not, the other
yeah.
thing is sometimes you do need to be a bit persistent with child and youth mental
yeah.
health, especially
okay.
for kids who have, this is a bit of a tangent, but kids who might not be talking about feeling anxious or talking about feeling down, who maybe have only like severe physical symptoms, like
right.
recurrent abdominal pain or headaches
yeah.
all the time, but you know that that's a physical manifestation of distress. Exactly,
yeah.
it's called somatization.
Mm-hmm.
And so kids with self-harm are often very similar. And so they may not admit, oh yeah, I'm feeling
right.
really down. It's just a behavior. And so you need to be the advocate saying, well, wait a minute, like this is the tip of the iceberg. And even if the kid doesn't admit
mm-hmm.
to these issues, we know there's something going on.
Right.
So child and youth mental health should be responsive to that, but they're just so overwhelmed. You need
right.
to advocate sometimes for the kids
okay.
who think really need it.
Thank you.
I had a question about like online peer support communities. You mentioned some of the risks around like group dynamics, and that's something that I've experienced in my work. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on, as a service provider, how to approach.
I'd actually like to ask Maddie that question. Maddie, have you heard the question about, I don't know if you ever went online and looked at a peer support community around self-harm, or if you have any experience with that?
What I ended up doing when I was self-harming was I went actually on a website, but it was like for kids who were self-harming, but a lot of the stuff was really triggering, or maybe there'd be a picture that someone posted of their cuts, and ultimately that was really detrimental to me because it made me feel kind of it made me triggered and want to do that more, or even ashamed that I wasn't at, if someone was doing it very seriously, which is kind of weird and kind of twisted when I think about it. But I was like, wow, like, I must be not that bad off because they're doing it way more than I am. But in the support, like the healthy support community, I've gone on different websites for help around self-harm. Like, I've gone on, like, MindCheck, and there's a Youth in BC one. And I've gone on, like, Kids Help Phones. And there's different websites I've found for different coping mechanisms, but I've never personally been on one that it was, like, a online community, so to say.
Yeah, I think...
I didn't actually know that they had those. That's really cool.
No, I think I'm thinking more of the groups that you're talking about.
I would really, like, thank you for saying that, Maddie, because that's what I would think, is that kids are so lonely. Like Maddie was saying before, it's because you can't talk to anyone that you take matters into your own hands, and often you're angry at your parents, or maybe your parents are actually the ones who are scaring you. So our job is to help youth find healthy adult connections, whether it's within their extended family or it's professional. Yeah, I wouldn't encourage peer support.
Mm-hmm. I think different peer support can work for different kind of mental health issues. I am running one around anxiety, and so far it's going really well. And I was actually part of a, like, in-person peer support group, like, I think it was 2 years ago before I moved. And it was really nice, but I think you really have to look out for the whole dynamic of, you know, becoming attached, and it's almost like saying, and I'm not going to say, like, okay, like, if you're struggling with self-harm and your best friend is, like, cut her off, like, I'm not saying that at all, and that was a really bad choice of words, but, oh gosh, okay, that was horrible, but for me, when I was in grade 8 and 9, I was in a group of people that some of them had struggled with self-harm, and that was a big conversation piece when we were all together. And at that point in my life, that wasn't something, because I was going through therapy and some of my other friends weren't. And so I had to kind of try and distance myself from them because I felt that that was having a negative influence on my own recovery process. So I definitely think you have to look out for stuff like that. Or, like, competitiveness, even. And it sounds weird. Like, oh, like, who would be competitive about something like that? But it's... I've witnessed it. Like, it happens. And it's really sad, but... And you have to look out for kids that are forming those kind of relationships.
Okay, I know we had a few other questions. Did you guys have a question on telehealth?
Hi, my name's Nancy. I just want to ask you, I'm wondering about self-harm behaviors that have more long-term effects, like swallowing batteries, where you don't get immediate, where there's nothing that happens immediately, but that you know that you're causing self-harm over the next month or something. How would that be different from the immediate self-harm, like cutting? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm assuming that's for me. I haven't seen that particular situation, but I have certainly worked with kids who are diabetic and who don't take their insulin properly, and it may lead to current issues, but it may be the accumulation of the high blood sugars or things like that. I think you want to understand with those that are more potentially life-threatening about the suicidal intent behind that.
Yeah.
It's all about intent. You can never tell by the gesture. You really have to understand what the person is thinking and expecting. That would be my first comment. And the more potential lethality there is to something, I guess the more urgent the and high level the mental health support needs to be.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, I think we have time for maybe one or two questions in the room. So go ahead.
I'm just curious, you mentioned before that it's you see it more prevalently in females, but it is also in males. So are there different kind of warning signs or symptoms to watch for when it comes to males as opposed to females?
Mm-hmm. I think what happens, this is a guess, I'm not 100, you know, this is just from my experience, but I think females are more likely to talk to each other about it and to do it in groups, so even though they're hiding it often from each other, and certainly from adults, they're more likely, so we know about it. Men, or boys, will do more of the kind of like pseudo-violent aggression, so getting into fist fights or something like that, where maybe they're drawing punches rather than maybe cutting themselves, so certainly boys and men cut too. Yeah, and like the overdoses and stuff we definitely see in boys as well. There's a lot more of the physical kind of trauma, banging, head, like hitting your head against a locker, those kind of more aggressive things. And also I think like self-harm can happen in people who are what we call internalizing, like they take stress in and it's more depression, anxiety, or externalizing, where it's more like conduct disorder behavior, which means vandalizing, shoplifting, fighting and stuff. And I think the boys who are getting into that stuff are at higher risk of self-harm also, just like they're at higher risk of suicide.
Okay, and maybe last question?
Sure, yeah. Same situation, we're struggling to help the kids who are aware of it. Mm-hmm. You know, who are talking to one another, who are going online at night, and what we're struggling with for the most part is they're constantly trying to help this girl.
Right.
And they're getting nowhere, and they're not understanding it, and we haven't quite figured out how to talk to them about it, or whether to. And we've asked, again, we went to mental health asking if someone could come in, and they refused.
Yeah. CART is also usually really good about this kind of thing, the school intervention, so maybe, I don't know. But with helping the friend, so you want to acknowledge again, validate what they're trying to do.
Yes.
Like, it's a really nice thing you're trying to do. You're a really good friend. And what we know, what can be helpful is, you know, talk to her about how she's doing, her family life, always, of course, being attentive to how it's affecting the kid, but let the adults deal with cutting. And I think as adults, we just really have to be firm sometimes about this is an issue that the adults are dealing with. We need to project confidence so that the kids can trust that we're actually, you know, putting our money where our mouth is, we're taking care of it. And if they know the kid, okay, her appointments are this day and this day, but this kid is probably worried because the supports are not in place for her friend, and she knows that.
Yeah.
So it goes back to your first question of once the adults are getting, then the other kid will relax a bit.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm just mindful of time. I'm realizing that it's 1:00, so I think we're going to end it right there. If anyone has questions they didn't get to ask, you can just email me or email the Kelty Center. And I'll pass them along to our speakers. And thanks to everyone who came, and thank you to our speakers. And have a great day, everyone.